You are tuned to KBBI AM 890 Homer, and this is The Coffee Table. I'm your host, Kathleen Gustafson. In studio today, it's the Cook Inlet Health Check with Angela Doroff and Bob Shavelson. I want the two of you to take a little time to introduce yourself. Angela, I don't think I could list all the affiliations that you have and the people you work with. Probably the same for you. You guys could go on half an hour with all the collaborations and everything. So, Angela, why don't you go first?
Certainly. Thanks for having me here today. And I work at the Ketchikmeot Bay Research Reserve, as Kathleen said, and one of my jobs is to coordinate with a lot of different people on a lot of different topics. Our mission is the health of the estuary, and that is a complex topic, and it ranges from the physical sciences like relative sea level rise, ocean acidification, to the biological. What kinds of foods do we eat in the bay? What kinds of animals do we support in that ecosystem structure, including, very importantly, salmon, juvenile salmon, clams, fish, the whole complement. That takes us with lots of different collaborations over time, depending on what topic we're working on. And the longer we're here, the more depth we have. So that's pretty cool.
If I look at the Research Reserve's front door, there's a sea of logos. I mean, how many organizations are housed there?
Right now, we're a federal-state partnership, so NOAA supports us with a sustaining grant for the reserve, and we're part of 29 reserves around the whole country. We're the only one in Alaska and the only subarctic reserve. That's really important. Our state partner is the new Alaska Conservation Science Division in University of Alaska Anchorage, and we work with our community council.
Okay, thank you. And Bob Shavelson from Inlet Keeper, who are you?
Well, first let me say thanks so much to KBBI for bringing back the coffee table. It's really exciting, and we missed it for a long time, and it's really one of the things that gives local voice to this radio. So very appreciative of that, so thanks. I, starting in 1995, I was the executive director of Cook Inlet Keeper, and I did that up until January 1st, and when I turned the reins over to a wonderful woman named Carly Weir, who's now our executive director. I am the director of advocacy now and the Inlet Keeper. Some people might not realize, but Cook Inlet Keeper was actually started in 1995 with the settlement of a Clean Water Act citizen suit against the oil industry for over 4,200 violations of the Clean Water Act. So rather than litigate and go to court and face substantial fines, the industry chose to direct some monies to start up Cook Inlet Keeper for a three-year project, which ended in 1998, and we've been able to sustain the program since then. So currently we have our headquarters here in Homer. We have offices in Soldotna and Anchorage, and we focus on water quality and salmon habitat protection.
And Angela Doroff and Bob Shavelson, I'm suspecting the two of you know each other. How do you work together in any capacity, or is it just checking up on each other all the time?
Well, I think the biggest link is salmon. Cook Inlet Keeper has had a strong salmon program for I don't know how many years now, many. And the watershed program in the Ketchikmeot Bay Research Reserve has had one as well, focusing on different things but highly complementary. And so Bob and I do move in a little bit different circles because I'm more in a marine ecology, nearshore ecosystem role. It's like having diverse portfolio when you're talking about environmental issues. There's the monitoring the science that can feed into the kinds of roles that Bob and his organization plays, and those are really critical for us to work well together on.
Yeah, and I would just say one of the first things that we did in 1995 and 96 was work to establish the National Estuarine Research Reserve, because Alaska's got more coastline than all the lower 48 states combined, and we did not have one of these estuarine research reserves, so we worked with a very broad collaboration. I mean, we had the Chamber of Commerce, we had the college, we had conservation groups, we had sportsmen's groups, we had really a very broad group of folks coming together to support this. And one of the most important things is it was all about science. It was not a regulatory program, it was about science and understanding our bay better so we can protect it and sustain the economies that support us.
Well, thank you both, and I want to get right to it. I am looking for an assessment of your priorities, your current priorities, what's going on with both of your organizations, and I do want to get to an update on Hillcorp. I want to say that I did attempt to contact Hillcorp, but they did not respond to calls and emails. Bob, if you would start with the current priorities for Inlet Keeper.
Well, our number one priority is climate change. We think that's the most pressing issue that faces all of society, not only in Alaska, but on the planet. And one of the things we're working with a group called Our Children's Trust right now, and this is a group that works with youth around Alaska and in the lower 48. And we're going to be asking the Department of Environmental Conservation to come up with an action plan on climate, because we've really been dragging our feet and there's no meaningful conversation going on about climate right now. And we'd like to see a plan that has actual goals and caps on emissions. So that's a really important thing. And one of the things that drives that is, you know, Angela mentioned salmon. You know, salmon is infused in everything we do because we recognize that salmon connect Alaskans unlike any other resource. You know, regardless of economics or religion or politics or anything, you can talk to anybody on the street about wild salmon and you're going to have a commonality there. So a lot of our work, our science work, has been looking at the intersection of climate and salmon and putting temperature data loggers in the salmon streams. And we're recognizing that these streams are warming at a rate that violates the Clean Water Act. It's the streams are too warm to support salmon. And we know by looking at California and Oregon and Washington that heat causes stress in fish and makes them more vulnerable to pollution and predation and disease. So that's really the foundation. We want to protect our salmon, and we believe we have to get our arms around climate change to do that.
So, Angela Doroff, you are directly involved in stream monitoring, aren't you?
In estuary monitoring.
Estuary monitoring.
Right. And Cooey Walker is our watershed specialist, and she's got, oh gosh, maybe a 16-year track record on looking at the freshwater interface on juvenile salmon, and that's where people meet the landscape and how human use of landscapes translates into the health of those tiny headwater streams and fish production, the nursery habitats, and the out-migrating juvenile smolt. So her work has been very pivotal for filling an information gap that our managers on a state and even national level haven't really had. And so I'm very thankful for her tenaciousness and her ability to work with that. And I think that work complements and deepens the work that Cook Inlet Keeper has been doing as well. So that's a really nice pairing. You know, as far as other things the reserve is working on, current projects, we just finished up, as I said, the Relative Sea Level Rise project, working with stakeholders and what that means for Alaska. You know, currently we're outpacing global sea level rise, but global sea level rise is a interactive, highly changeable figure. So with our isostatic readjustment of melting glaciers and our tectonic strain, we're outpacing it for the moment. And so,
okay, you just said isostatic. So can you elaborate and go into a little more detail about this?
Sure. I'm smiling because I thought I had that beat out of me by our wonderful educators and our CTP coordinator. I guess not. Basically, when you put a heavy weight on the earth, it depresses it. As that ice melts, and it's melting quite rapidly in our glacial ice masses, it releases, and there's a release in the crust of the earth. And that's what we're seeing. We're seeing a rise from that. And the biggest example is from Southeast Alaska, where they're gaining new land as a result of that, primarily. This is a unique area because we're gaining land from tectonic strain post-64 quake and the ice melting.
I remember hearing about climate change being much more easily measurable, happening quicker because we're closer to the poles. Have I got that right?
Changes in ice dynamics are happening more quickly.
And that's not about our position.
Well, it is. It's about the position to the poles and how that's changing and how those freshwater inputs are changing rates of global sea level rise in sometimes episodic ways. And so we are. There's that vulnerability because we're the cold going to warm.
So Bob Shavelson from Inlet Keeper, I was hoping to hear some oil and gas talk from you, because I've got Cook Inlet Regional Citizens Advisory Council annual report from last year, and they're talking about last July, the Drift River oil terminal spill in July, Beaver Creek. In November, the Tyonic Platform diesel spill in response. But I know that since the beginning of the year, in March and February, March and April, there have been platform shutdowns. If you could help update us on what's running and what isn't.
There's several platforms that are in what's called lighthouse mode. Mm-hmm. They have chosen to keep in that kind of worm mode. You know, from our perspective, that's an effort to avoid the cost of dismantling them, which are substantial, and which is another thing that we're concerned about. But, you know, I think it's important to recognize, you know, Cook Inlet is the birthplace of commercial oil and gas. You know, before Prudhoe Bay came online, Cook Inlet was the place. And in 1956, an ARCO geologist named Bill Bishop famously put his boot heel into the tundra up in what's now the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge up in the Swanson River field, and said, drill here, and they did, and they hit oil. And after that, the development quickly ensued, and you had onshore development, and then it quickly went offshore to the platforms that we have now, 16 platforms in Upper Cook Inlet. And there's a lot of things that make Cook Inlet unique, not just the you know, the wonderful beauty and the natural resources we have, but, you know, Cook Inlet is the only coastal water body in the United States where the oil industry is legally permitted under the Clean Water Act to dump billions of gallons of toxic waste. And that's a loophole that arose because the development predated our major federal environmental laws, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, things like that that occurred in the 1970s. So that's one of the issues that we see, but also recognize that the infrastructure we're looking at here is more than 50 years old. And Cook Inlet is an incredibly unforgiving place. So when you think about a steel pipe on the floor of Cook Inlet for 50 years, you have to know that it's going to fail. So that's what we've been seeing with Hilcorp. Hilcorp is an independent, privately held company out of Texas, and their business model is to come into areas where there's old oil and gas infrastructure and try to wring out the last profits in those. And that's what we're seeing here. So it's no surprise that we're seeing increasing incidents of spills and leaks.
I wanted to know about measuring pipeline performance. We're talking about the regulations and the enforcement, and who oversees all of that? I mean, there's the state, and is there also federal oversight?
Yeah, and that's the problem. You don't have good uniform oversight. There's kind of a patchwork, and that's what we saw in the natural gas leak that Hilcorp had this year. You know, you had the state saying, well, we don't have jurisdiction over this, and you had the Fed saying, well, we do, but we don't consider this a huge problem. So that's one of the issues that you have here. And I'm heartened because as a result of all the attention that's been brought about by this, there is now going to be a risk assessment of pipelines in Cook Inlet, and that's much needed, because we need to, if there's going to be production of oil and gas in Cook Inlet, it needs to be done responsibly, and with the current infrastructure, that's not possible.
And who does the risk assessment, both the state and federal, or just?
Right now, it looks like it's going to be the Cook Inlet Regional Citizens Advisory Council working with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation.
A person could get the idea that you're against all pipelines, but I know there is a pipeline in Cook Inlet you'd like to see put in. Can you talk about that?
Let me first say that Cook Inlet Keeper's position is we need to move rapidly away from fossil fuel development. Fossil fuel, our addiction to fossil fuel, as President Bush recognized, is the cause of rapid climate change. And, you know, Angela talked about the disproportionate effects here in Alaska. I mean, no one is seeing the effects like us. We are on the front lines of climate change. You just have to look at, you know, the aphids, the seabird die-off, the clam die-offs, you know, the rising incidence of paralytic shellfish poisoning. There's so many things that we can point to that are quantifiable effects from climate change. So we've got to get our hands around that. Drift River Oil Terminal is on the west side of Cook Inlet. They put an oil storage facility at the base of an active volcano, and it's the most ridiculous place to store oil. And in 2009, that really became apparent, because they had 6 million gallons sitting there when the volcano went off and they had to evacuate the facility. So there'd be no way to respond to a large oil spill there. A larger risk occurred in 1989 and 90 when the Exxon Valdez was capturing everyone's attention, but there was 20 million gallons of oil stored there. So as long as you have the regularity of eruptions of a volcano, you shouldn't be storing oil there. And I think we've been pressing on this issue for a number of years.
I was just about to say that. Yeah. I've been hearing about this for years.
Yeah.
So what kind of movement is happening?
It sounds like Hilcorp has made the commitment to shut down that facility and put in a state-of-the-art pipeline to alleviate the need to store oil at the base of the volcano, and also to tanker it across the inlet, which is a very risky proposition. So if you have a state-of-the-art pipeline that has very good spill response technology embedded in it, that's much safer than what we have now.
And Angela Doroff, the research reserve, is involved in water quality testing. Where does someone go to see your reports?
Well,
also, if you could talk a little bit about the testing, I'd appreciate it.
Oh, sure. I'm going to break it up in a couple sections. Part of the National Estuarine Research Reserve System has a water quality monitoring program that's standard across all reserves. And to do that, we have these water quality sounds at the surface and 1 meter above the depth at Homer Harbor, Saldovia Harbor, and then seasonally one at Bear Cove. And that does water temperature, salinity, dissolved oxygen, turbidity, and chlorophyll, surface chlorophyll probes. And so, you know, that's...
So chlorophyll, is that the algae blooms?
It's an indice of phytoplankton production. And I won't get into it any more deeper than that, but it tells you when the system's gearing up again. It's light dependent. It's the fluorescence. And that's really important to know when your phytoplankton bloom is gearing up in the spring. This year it was late March, and we saw it multiple ways. We saw it in our long-term monitoring. We saw it in our Gulf Watch Alaska project, which is an EVOS-funded trustee council project. And then we saw it with our community-based phytoplankton monitoring program. So all three of those things helped us point to narrowing down when the spring bloom was. And that's important because then your zooplankton bloom, and that becomes food for fish and whales. And you see the whole system starting to gear up once that happens. Our ability with these monitoring programs then lets us link it to the biology. And so that monitoring program for Gulf Watch Alaska included Cook Inlet, a transect across Cook Inlet from Anchor Point to Red River, from Augustine Island to Flat Island, and then from Point Adam to Cape Douglas. And so we have 5 years of temperature conductivity, vertical profiling, zooplankton, phytoplankton, and water samples for ocean acidification. That next five-year plan looks a little bit different, but it's more refined to help pin down oceanographic processes. And that's done with the Kitsitsina Bay Lab and Chris Holdreed. Many of you know her. It's a pretty strong team.
And where can someone, so your website is where someone can go to?
Our university website is still growing and learning and getting itself on its feet, but the Gulf Watch Alaska website has all the raw data. It has interpretations of the data. It has educational outreach materials. Our Research Reserve website will have that relatively soon, too. And the Phytoplankton Monitoring Group is also getting online, working with Alaska Ocean Observing System and having a data portal, and we're working on sort of interpretation tools with NOAA and getting that online, too.
And Gulf Watch Alaska, who is that?
That is a grant that the first 5 years was led by Alaska Ocean Observing System. This next round is with NOAA, Mandy Lindbergh, and it is a long-term monitoring grant by the Exxon Valdez Trustee Council, and it is meant to be for 20 years of long-term monitoring to support the understanding and mitigation of injured resources from the Exxon Valdez oil spill.
And 20 years really isn't a long time, is it, when
no,
you're monitoring?
No, it really wasn't, in the sense that I'm really thankful that people who were involved early on in the oil spill response to that project recognized and did very good work in documenting that it took a long time for oil to come out of that. The pitting and the residual and lingering oil really stayed around a long time in the subarctic system. That was really important to know.
So any listeners that have questions about the oil and gas and about the pipelines and maintenance and regulations and enforcement, we will be opening up the phones pretty soon. But I do want to move on to dams and streams and generating energy projects that are underway and ones that have been stopped. Bob Shavelson from Inlet Keeper, can you talk to me a little bit about energy generation in the inlet?
Sure. I think it's important to recognize that all energy generation is going to have some footprint, and the question for us as a society is what's an acceptable footprint. We don't believe that fossil fuels are an acceptable footprint anymore in light of climate change. Then you get into renewable energy, and hydropower can be a wonderful renewable energy resource, and you then have to look at, is it going to impact fish and to what extent? And so, for example, we had a large project here that was proposed originally in the 1980s, and it reared its head several years years ago, and that was the Susitna Dam project. And, you know, we looked at that, and even before the studies came out, we knew that it was going to do two things. And the Susitna River is a major salmon producer for Cook Inlet. And we knew that project was going to do two things. First, it was going to affect the flow of the river and the flow regime and the timing of different flow stages. And second, we recognized it was going to change the temperature of the stream. And so flow and temperature are vital to salmon survival. And so right off the bat, we said that's unacceptable because it's such a large system there. You know, with that said, you know, we've been supportive of Bradley Lake. You know, there was a small run in Bradley Lake here in Ketchumack Bay. They're trying to expand that a little bit. And so, you know, there's a line that you don't want to cross. And when you get a substantial system like Susitna, that's the line that was crossed. And recently we had a project come out of the Chugach Electric Cooperative out of Anchorage, and they wanted to put a large head dam within the Kenai River watershed, and that was the Snow River Dam. And the fascinating thing about that was that, you know, I talked about salmon values and how they connect Alaskans unlike any other resource, and, you know, we've had a series of large mega projects. We've had the Pebble Mine, we've had the Chewitna Coal Mine, we've had the Susitna Dam, and salmon was the connecting force in all these things. So when the Snow River Dam reared its head, there was an organic backlash from Alaskans that just said, no, we do not want large head hydroelectric power in the Kenai River watershed, because again, we know it's going to affect flow, we know it's going to affect temperature. And within 1 month, that project was retracted. So that was fairly remarkable, and to me, a strong demonstration of how important wild, healthy salmon are to Alaskans.
Well, we are going to get a little later to the topic of citizen science and activism, but I want to ask you right now, you said Alaskans banded together and said no. By what means?
Well, when I said it was an organic effort, you know, a group of folks that fish in that watershed came together collectively, and they formed their own group, you know, very quickly. They saw the threat, and they weren't happy with it, so they came together, formed a new group, and then there was a lot of other people, ordinary citizens, that just weighed in with Chugach Electric, which held several public meetings. And so Chugach, the board, listened to that feedback and realized that they were, you know, looking at a buzzsaw and they didn't want to deal with it.
You are tuned to The Coffee Table on KBBI, AM 890, Homer, and KBBI.org. And the phones are open. Call 235-7721 or 800-979-5224. If you have a question for Angela Doroff from the Ketchumack Bay National Estuarine Research Reserve or Bob Shavelson from Inlet Keeper. Bob, I interrupted you with our theme music. I wanted to hear a little more about energy generation in the inlet.
Well, I think it's important to recognize that all around us in Cook Inlet, we have world-class renewable energy potential. You know, we've got the second highest tides in North America outside the Bay of Fundy. We've got 5 active volcanoes that can drive geothermal energy. We've got excellent wind potential. And so it's really just about how we prioritize our energy needs as a society. And right now, we put all our eggs into the oil and gas basket. And that has a couple issues attached to it. One, we see our state is in a fiscal crisis because we continue to rely only on oil and gas, and that's not a diversified economy. And so we're seeing cuts to seniors and schools and roads and education and things like that, while the oil companies are still reaping considerable profits and taking more than their fair share. On the other side of that, if we made the decision as a society to invest in renewable energy, we could have long-term jobs, we could be exporting those jobs and the technology and the know-how, but we need that political will to make that transition.
Well, thanks, Bob. I do have a caller on the line. Roberta, are you there?
I am. Thank you. So, just a couple of thoughts. What a good time for this program since we've had some things going on up in the inlet with Hillcorp having multiple spills and, of course, the gas line that they could not fix because there was too much ice. And some of us have been saying forever that doing work in the winter here is dangerous. And because of the ice, you cannot fix things. And that just got proven again. And then they had the actual oil spill. Something hit the platform, probably ice, and had an oil spill. They're saying it's 3 gallons. It's kind of hard to believe. But it just reminds us of how vulnerable these platforms and pipelines are with the kind of environment that Cook Inlet is. And then, of course, the Drift River. So we are just proving one more time that, no, you should not be doing this stuff in the winter because of our conditions, and it just continued to be ignored. One of the things that I've dreamt about is that we turn the platforms into solar, wind, and tidal power, and we, if, because of climate change and ocean acidification and spills, we just close all the oil and gas platforms down and get on our way with renewables. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Roberta. Bob or Angela, do you guys have a response to that comment?
No.
No. She covered it?
Yep.
She covered it well.
Well, what do you think about the feasibility of turning those platforms into alternative energy generation stations? Do you think that's a reasonable goal?
I think we can do anything we set our minds to. I'm disappointed that collectively as a society we're setting the bar too low. I think if we had an Apollo project for renewable energy, we could do anything. We could be 100% renewable within 20 years if that was our goal. But, you know, there's forces at play here that are holding us back. I've been reading a book called Dark Money by Jane Mayer, and she's talking about how people like the Koch brothers and their oil and gas interests are infesting our political process. And we can see it here in Alaska. You can see Americans for Prosperity regularly on Facebook and in our newspaper advocating a pro-oil and gas line. So it's very difficult to combat the billions and billions of dollars that are being put into this propaganda campaign and to press for a sustainable future based on renewable energy.
And I guess I would add to that is that, you know, the other piece of this puzzle is that not only do we have the creativity in this community, in this region, in this state to take some of these things on, we also have the stewardship of, you know, of the people who live here about finding ways to do that in a environmentally, ecologically sound way. So every source, every action we take on the planet, whether it's renewable or oil and gas, has a certain, you know, there's a certain compromise that makes you need to make. And the climate change impacts of fossil fuels are huge, and the rest of the globe knows that now too. But we can work with all of these other ways of exploring renewable energy and do it in an environmentally responsible way. And we have the creativity and capacity to do that, and the science tools to support it.
And there is another call on the line. Findlay, do you read?
Yes.
Go ahead, Findlay.
Well, I have a comment first, and that is people keep saying that climate change is the greatest thing of problem facing humanity, but I disagree. It's war. You know, it's so much misery, so much waste, and so much, you know, adding to the climate problem from war, but it's such a difficult problem to deal with because it's psychology, religion, sovereignty, and all that. But here's the idea question I wanted to ask. What about putting a power station on Augustine Island? They could drill into that hot spot and probably produce huge quantities of electricity, right? And then maybe convert that to hydrogen or have some huge electric storage barges, you know, a port on the other side of Augustine. So anyway, that's just an idea that it occurred to me. It's pretty far out, but what do you think of it?
Well, I know that Bob had spoken earlier about the dangers of producing energy and storing stuff at the base of an active volcano. What do you think, Bob? Does that fall under the same category?
Well, I think you could tap into the geothermal potential that's there and not necessarily put a facility at risk right on the island. But I think that's certainly plausible and feasible. And you know, the problem we have now is the capital investment. Is it going to come from government or is it come from private money? And right now, there's not the incentive set up for private investment. We subsidize the oil and gas and coal industries enormously. There is not a level playing field. And yet, we don't have those same subsidies for renewable energy. So
I was just about to ask that question.
Yeah.
Is there anything on the horizon or any subsidies available? for developing alternative energy?
Yeah, they're very limited compared to oil and gas. Again, it's because the money on the oil and gas and coal side is enormous, and it affects our legislation and our Congress and our policies that come from it. But let me make one comment. You know, I said that climate change is the greatest problem that faces us. It's really the greatest symptom, and the underlying problem is really our growth on the planet. We've got a finite planet, and if you look at the beginning of the Industrial Revolution in the late 1700s, we had 1 billion people on the planet. Well, you know, fast forward several hundred years, and now we've got 7.2 billion people on the planet, and everybody wants a car and an air conditioner, refrigerator, and an iPhone. And so it's really the growth of our population, and that is the foundation of our whole economy, right? If our economy doesn't grow every quarter, you get this collective hand-wringing that the gross domestic product's not growing and the stock market's not growing. So that's the inherent problem, and that's really hard to get to because nobody wants to talk about perpetual growth.
Okay, thanks, Bob Shavelson. Next on the line is Bill. Bill, are you there?
I am. Hello. Thank you very much for having this on the air today, a most important subject. A couple of weeks ago, there was an article in the Alaska Dispatch with a picture of a diver inspecting the rigs in the gas line and how dangerous it was because of the high wind, tides, and waves. You know, and thinking that's the solution right there, but they're still working on the fossil fuel industry, and it's people like who have bought and paid for our Juno representatives, Michiki on down, that work for the oil industry that do not want to see alternative. NOAA, when they dropped the buoys a few years ago in the inlet through with, I think it was the vessel Susitna that dropped them, NOAA determined the inlet would generate enough power for the west coast of North America if we could tap it all. We don't need to tap it all, but just slightly on the edge would produce enough extra power that we could run data centers here for electronics and communications, which would be thousands of clean energy jobs, just the political will. But one thing right now, I just wanted to make the comment was, Bradley Lake, we already have the transmission lines running from there through the Caribou Hills, which on the wind maps for national wind surveys is purple. It's the highest wind generation areas in the Americas, and it's already got a transmission line through it. At the same time, the assembly and the power company in Homer, AGA, was trying to buy a coal plant instead of tapping into that. What my question is there enough community support to look into coming up with our own cooperative like they did in the Dakotas and Montana and Kansas too? As a community, everybody put up $1,000 or whatever to put the initial wind generation out there as a test plant and then start expanding on that, which has been a huge success in the Plain States. There's a lot of other things, but thanks for your time.
Thanks for calling. I want to ask Angela Doroff. Bill was just saying when NOAA dropped the buoys. Do you know what he's talking about there?
Unfortunately, I don't. the first project when I hired on at the reserve in 2008, I was between jobs and I was doing everything on my iPhone and reviewing the tidal energy proposals and looking at the end of the spit as an incubator project that would be a test bed for different kinds of resources and looking at tidal flow and energy production. And the city of Homer was very active in that. They had a small grant that took them just this far, and we didn't really close the loop on it, I think. And so I think there's more to understand about that. There's more to do, because like when you're pulling energy out, what are you doing, you know, to the sediment structure, and is that what you want to be doing? So I think from, you know, a science inventory monitoring perspective, there's more to be done with understanding it. And I don't, I maybe Bob has a more continuous picture of that than I do, so I'll launch it back his way.
What say you, Bob?
Well, there's a wonderful group called the Alaska Ocean Observing System, and they've worked with NOAA and a host of other state and federal agencies and private partners, and they put a series of data buoys around Cook Inlet and elsewhere. And if you look them up on the internet, they've got a really nice interactive map, and you can click on and you can see the data. They have put a buoy in basically, in the middle of Kachemak Bay, and it gives you all kinds of data, including wave data.
Is that the one the surfers look for?
Absolutely.
Everybody looks for that.
Yeah.
So that
tell me again how to access that. Where is it?
And you might have
better information. So go to the AOOS. Data portal and look for the wave buoy. It's buoy 108 if you're listening to the marine weather, and it'll give you wave height, sea surface temperature, maybe it even gives salinity, I can't remember. But that is a wonderful program. So that doesn't necessarily tell us about, it tells us about wave energy and sediment transport and wave height and how to save fossil fuel by not running your boat out to fish on those grounds when the waves are too high. So it's actually been a very good community support, but it doesn't tie back into that tidal energy piece. And so that's why I had the disconnect.
Yeah.
We use that all the time too.
And I would just say, a lot of conventional thinking about tidal power is we're trying to capture the lateral movement of our tides. But I think, especially here when we have such great tidal exchanges, you need to look at the vertical exchange. I mean, if you last week went down to our dock and you saw, millions and millions of pounds of crab boats and other things going up to a plus 24 and dropping down to a negative 5 and thinking about the potential energy within that system, we have the wherewithal to capture that if we dedicate ourselves to it.
We also have a wonderful time series with our CTD, our temperature conductivity depth profiles now. For 5 years, we're going to be starting our next 5 years of that project too, which helps address that vertical, what's happening in the structure of that water. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So back to the phones. Bill, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, the vertical idea, I think it's a good idea. And I've often thought that maybe the state could take over one of these mothball platforms or be in line to take one over out in the inlet. And it would be the ideal platform for energy studies from wind to current to rise and fall. I mean, you could use rise and fall of the tide basically like a cuckoo clock. You pull these little weights up and they run the clock for a couple of days. And it doesn't matter if it's inefficient because it's free. And I've just often thought that would be a good way for the state to do some really healthy research.
Well, the cuckoo clock image is a good one because I was having a hard time visualizing it, and now I've got it. Angela or Bob, do you have something to add for that?
Well, one of the other things I wanted to mention, too, is there's really a collective, a high-power, good group of physical oceanographers. And since I've been living in the Homer area, there is a Cook Inlet Modeling Working Group that meets intermittent, I would say. There's been a number of ocean circulation models. The last one was specifically done for the tidal energy. Seth Danielson, UAF, Mark Johnson, UAF. All these people work worldwide with ocean circulation modeling and dynamics and freshwater forcing inputs. And there is getting to be a critical mass of very high resolution data for Cook Inlet, Kachemak Bay, Lower Cook Inlet. And so I think sometimes in the science and monitoring world, we need that bridge to take that to the actionable place that Bob sits in with the Cook Inlet Keeper. So I just wanted to put that out there is that, part of what we try to do at the reserve is create these opportunities and these bridges of information to actionable places.
And Bill, do you feel like that addressed your statement in question?
Well, partially. Going back to these old oil platforms, I still just want to emphasize that they're perfect laboratories. So, anyway.
Thanks a lot.
That's all. Thank you.
I would add one thing, Kathleen, and I certainly agree with the caller, but again, I go back to the fact that we are in a fiscal crisis because we put our eggs in the oil and gas basket, and so we need to diversify our economy, and I think renewable energy is the way to do it, but again, it comes back to the political will. But, you know, the idea that renewable energy is free energy, I think we really need to cement that down because, you know, the sun drives the wind and it drives the ocean currents on our planet. And right now, that is free. So all you're talking about is the capital cost to install the infrastructure to capture that energy. On the other side, you have large corporations who have a profit motive and they want to sell you their oil, gas, and coal because they can make money off it. And so,
well,
that's
I think
the
for
big
that
economy.
Reason, for that reason and others, when you said we'd need an Apollo project, it's that ambitious as putting someone on the moon, taking oil and gas off the table. I don't feel very optimistic that that's going to happen anytime soon. Changing people's behavior is the hardest thing. It's,
well, I just say free energy can change that behavior.
Oh, what's out there? What platforms are out there that are not in use right now? Some places you can point to on a map?
Yeah, there certainly are, and there's others that are probably near the end of their lifespan. And again, it comes down to the investment and who's going to make it. Is it going to be public or is it going to be private? And are there incentives for private investment? So that's the hurdle. And, you know, right now there is this stranglehold on our entire political system by the fossil fuel industry, and they want to continue reaping profits as long as they can. The writing is on the wall. You know, China, India, these other countries, they recognize they're investing heavily in renewable energy, and we're doubling down on failed policies of the past. So if it's going to be bad for the United States, it's going to be bad for Alaska if we don't open our eyes and catch up to what the future's bringing.
So we have what you're saying is we have an opportunity to be very innovative and stay on top of the market if we start developing these things globally.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So there's another caller on the line. Jeff, do you read?
Kathleen.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, I just wonder what everybody there thinks about, and everybody listening thinks about, in particular, locally here, the Cook Inlet Association introducing millions more salmon smolt hatchery fish into our waters with, you know, the change that's going on. You know, in my opinion, I think hatchery fish are weaker fish to begin with. And now they're, you know, with all this change, and now they're talking about dumping millions, and this is also going on in Southeast as well.
Okay, Bob or Angela?
Sure. Thanks, Jeff, for the question. And let me just say, we support the commercial fishing industry 110%. It's really the lifeblood of our coastal communities. And there has been some questions raised about the introduction of large numbers of hatchery smolt into certain areas. For example, there is a proposal to add 100 million smolt to the back of Tutka Bay, and that's drawn some attention. And I think one of the basic questions is, what do 100 million smolt eat when they're released into the environment? And we don't have the science to answer that question. Until we do, I think, you know, it's irresponsible to move forward. I think we need answers to those questions because, you know, I looked a couple years ago, the state came out with something called the Alaska Wildlife Action Plan, and they recognized that there's 8 billion more salmon in the North Pacific than there were 50 years ago. Well, why is that? Well, it's because of hatcheries. So the next question is, well, what is the carrying capacity of the North Pacific? I mean, when we look at the open ocean, it is really a black box. We have so little understanding of the dynamics. So everyone's scratching their head. Well, why are the king salmon herding across the state? Why are they smaller? We don't have any idea. And the complexity of natures are so great that I think we need to take a precautionary approach to it and really understand what we're doing before we do it, because Cook Inlet has over 94% wild stocks in it, and I think that is something that we want to preserve. And there's a lot of science out there that shows that not only do smolt create competition for prey, but there's genetic dilution that occurs and things like that. So we support commercial fishing 110%, but I think we have to answer some of these questions.
And those environmental questions are not easily answered, but I think they are important. And, you know, we're going to be, I know it because it's Kitsune Bay Lab and the Research Reserve are both focusing some extra monitoring effort in Tutka Bay right now to help us start to frame that picture better.
And I know last night at the Borough Assembly meeting, the Cook Inlet Aquaculture Association gave a presentation on their salmon enhancement program, and they were talking about places like Tutka Bay. I will definitely be putting that up on the website along with this coffee table?
Kathleen?
Yes.
On the cooking at the association here, the director himself, you're talking about how the ocean is vast and questionable out there, and yet they're talking about, you know, throwing millions more wild cards in there at this point in, you know, in history. And I think something people need to think about, too, is it may be vast, but the continental shelf is somewhat limited compared to the, you know, the size of the ocean, and that's where most of the life is going on.
Okay, thanks for calling, Jeff. And Bob, I saw you making notes.
I just want to add one more thing. There will be the Department of Natural Resources and the Department of Fish and Game are coming down to Homer on May 15th, and they will have a listening session about the Net Pens in Tucker Bay along with the management plan for the Kachemak Bay State Park, and that will be at 6 p.m. May 15th at the Island and Ocean Visitor Center.
I just got an email about that yesterday.
Thank you, Kathleen, and Bob, and Angela, I think it is.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's just about time for a little summation, and I am not so awful as to ask you to give a short assessment of the health of Cook Inlet, but I do want to know where you feel like, especially, I was reading reports from 1997, from 2002, from 2006, from Inlet Keeper. I'd like to know what's coming next and the progress you feel like you've made. Or do you feel like you've made progress?
I think there's progress. I think people, there's a growing recognition that we need to treat our resources in a responsible manner if we want them to stick around. There's so many examples of the demise of wild salmon. We can look at Europe, you can look at New England, you can look at the Pacific Northwest, and the thing that jumps out is that it wasn't just negligence that caused the demise of these runs. It was a willfulness. It was knowing what we were doing was having adverse impacts and doing it anyway. So hopefully we're learning on that. And one of the things that we've gotten out of, for example, the debate over the Pebble Mine or the debate over the Chewitna Coal Strip Mine.
I just got a question about fracking.
Yeah.
So if you could help us.
Sure.
Yeah.
But let me just wrap up and say, we recognized in these debates around the Pebble and Chewitna and other projects that our laws around protecting salmon habitat have not been changed since statehood in 1959, and they're very loose and they're very squirrely. And you know, a lot of people said, well, there's no way that they would allow a coal company to mine through 14 miles of a salmon stream on the west side of Cook Inlet. Well, yeah, the law doesn't prohibit it. So we're working. There's legislation right now called HB 99. Lois Stutz from Kodiak has introduced it, and it tries to put some sideboards. It tries to put some definiteness to our salmon protection rules. And so that's something that I think everybody should pay attention to, and we're going to be pushing that and along with other things to make sure that there's not so much discretion, that we have some hard, fast rules to protect salmon habitat.
And Angela?
Well, one of the things that we do is develop our research and monitoring program and integrate it into the community. Our coastal training program is going to be work. It just got a grant, Sabrina Abrahamson, to work with small businesses and look at that as an interface to our healthy ecosystems approach, how small businesses can navigate climate change and changing ecosystems. So that's a very exciting thread. Our Salmon and Society project that Cooey Walker leads has a similar bent. That's also a very strong role. And I've been more oceanographic and nearshore, and what we're working is with the citizen science, integrating a large-scale clam habitat mapping and ocean circulation and ocean acidification kind of composite program for not only Homer but the surrounding communities across the bay, and working very closely with the Aleutic Pride Shellfish Hatchery, UAF, and our local communities of Port Graham, Nanwalek, and Seldovia.
Fracking should be a whole other hour as far as I'm concerned, but do you have any information that you can share about local fracking that's going on in the inlet?
Sure. Fracking in the standardized realm has been going on for a long time in Alaska, and well perforations and stimulations and trying to get oil and gas out of the ground. It's not just like you stick a straw in there and it flows. That's been going on. But the modern advent of fracking that includes directional drilling and different chemical compositions of these fracking fluids blasted at high pressures into these formations, that is relatively new. And Bluecrest moved into the Cosmopolitan unit there just south south is Drisky Creek, right on the bluff. You can see the rig up there now. And they were going to frack very deep under the water there, and that caused a lot of consternation. And we realized when we looked at it that there's no rule that, requires the oil and gas companies to actually make these permits open for public notice and comment. So that was the first step that we wanted to take, and we've gone through that process with the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. They went through one iteration. It looks like they're going to give us some type of public comment, but we didn't feel like it was enough, so we went back to the well, and hopefully they're going to come out with a final rule soon that says we have more rights to know.
So some of you know that the Research Reserve, in collaboration with NOAA and other partners, just did a climate resiliency series of workshops that were helping frame the community and community ideas about climate change and what we can do and actionable items. And that was a very diverse group of people that had lots of different kind of action items, including groundwater hydrology, seed banks, roads and infrastructures, sediment transport, coastal erosion. All of those very important topics had just small groups of people saying, here's what I can do. And so if there's interest in joining any of those groups, Sabrina Abrahamson is leading them. And the other thing is, there was an Artists No Climate Change piece of that that is now has a little show up in KBay Coffee. So,
when you're talking about calls for public comment, where does a person go to find those out and all the supporting materials? We will be putting some links on our website, like inletkeeper.org, for instance.
Well, for the fracking, you go to the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. But let me just say, you know, we lost a program several years ago. Frank Murkowski and Sean Parnell let die the Alaska Coastal Management Program. And as I mentioned before, Alaska's got more coastline than all the lower 48 states combined, yet we're the only state that doesn't have a coastal management program. And that program was kind of a one-stop shop, and that let Alaskans see all the permits and authorizations regarding a project in one place. Now it's scattered all over the place, and it's very difficult for people to engage, so I think that's something that we can talk to our legislators about and say, hey, we want a one-stop shop so we can see what's going on in our backyard.
Because now those coastal management decisions are being made solely on the federal level.
We don't have any program here.
None of that.
We have nothing here, no.
So Bob Shavelson from Inlet Keeper and Angela Doroff from Kachemak Bay National Estuarine Research Reserve, thank you so much for being on the coffee table today. Final words?
Thanks for bringing the coffee table back. Really love it.
Loved being here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I so appreciate that. You have been listening to The Coffee Table on KBBI, AM 890 Homer.